Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Restaurant Guys.
So you're going to keep doing that until I include it in my intro, aren't you?
You're an old dog, Marky. You're an old dog. Hey, I'm out there tweeting all the time. I want people to know what we're tweeting about.
Right.
Yeah, go to Twitter, follow us, and we'll send you a nice welcome message and nothing else, really.
But you really are going to keep doing that until I add it to the intro, aren't you?
I want people to follow us on Twitter and retweet all our crazy cool things that we're tweeting out. So what are we talking about today, brother?
Today we're going to talk with Ron Cooper about mezcal.
Mezcal. Ay-ya-ya-ya-ya!
What?
I don't know.
You just became a Jamaican bobsledder. What was that all about?
I don't know. It was like from a cartoon or something. But yeah, mezcal, no worm. That's the topic of our show. But you know, before we do that, I want to enlighten our listeners on a meat tour we just went to. A meat tour? That sounds weird, doesn't it? We went to one of our butchers, and who shall remain nameless. And we have a couple of different purveyors that we buy meat from. But some of these guys are doing such great meats of all different sorts, and the dry aging facilities that are out there now are simply amazing. And we got to look at 60-day dry aged steaks.
You know, and I think you just used exactly the right expression. They're simply amazing.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, these rooms are very simple.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, you know, things are tagged and, you know, you measure when it came in and its weight when it came in, the date it came in, and you measure its weight and the date it goes out.
And what was really interesting about visiting a facility is we recently had one of the people we buy from, and we often visit our purveyors, especially if, you know, super high-end items like some of the aged steaks we get. Mm-hmm. And they had to move from Manhattan, and they moved to a modern facility that they built out in Jersey. And it was really phenomenally interesting to see how efficient a very old practice can be done. Modern technology can make a very old practice very efficiently done. And to go and look at their entire stocks of the different kinds of beef that we use and some that we only use occasionally, and to see it and touch it and at each, you know, 4 or 5 days of the aging process and to see how dry-aged meat changes. And they also,
that was fun. One of the things we did there was we looked at a 7-day meat next to 14-day meat next to 21-day meat next to 28-day meat
next to 35-day meat next to 45-day meat,
and how the meat changed and what happened over time.
And we had this great seminar where we sat down and we plotted out exactly, you know, a lot of people don't know the difference between dry aging and wet aging, because no one really says wet aging. They just say aged. This is an aged steak. When you dry a piece of meat, when you age a piece of meat, it's out there dry in the air,
and that's exactly it. It's in the open air. Wet aging, basically, you're taking something and you're using
cryovacing it. You're sealing it somehow, and you're putting liquid in there so it doesn't dry out. What happens when steak ages? Well, the fibers break down and it becomes more tender, and an aged steak is easier to chew. It's that beautiful tender steak that you love. What happens with dry aging is you also get a development of flavors that are out there as the beef slowly oxidizes on the outside and forms kind of an almost crust on the outside.
To me, wet aging does nothing but make a steak softer.
Yes, it doesn't make it.
And to me, it makes it a less pleasant steak. So if anybody says wet aging, I automatically move away from that. Choice and pick.
Right. I'd rather have a 7-day steak than a 28-day wet aged steak. Now, a lot of places do a combination of dry and wet aging, where they'll dry age it for a certain period of time and then they'll wet age it further. The dry aged steaks are much more expensive. We looked, and what was fascinating about being able to visit this place was their tagging system is so good. They write the weight of each piece of meat down when it comes into the aging room, and then they weigh it during the course of the aging of the meat. It's kind of like a patient's chart, you know, and you can see exactly how much meat is lost.
Yeah, unlike me,
how much weight is lost.
Unlike me, the meat loses weight over time, as opposed to
that's because they don't feed it, Mark. let's be fair. You know, but it was just amazing to see the investment that they make in something like that, and it was amazing to see the quality that's out there. And so when you have dry-aged meat. And by the way, when you get dry-aged meat at home, one of the things that you want to look for is if a steak is more than, say, 14 or certainly into the 20-something days, when you cut that supermarket steak or when you cut that young steak on your plate, it expresses a lot of liquid. You know, you get that juicy steak that sort of is all over your plate when you're done, or when you put the fork in, it juices out. Well, that's not a dry-aged steak. When the steak's been dry-aged for anywhere, you know, around 20 days or more.
Yeah, 20, once you get to 21 days, you shouldn't have a lot of liquid on
the plate. Yeah, very little liquid should express
that. Or someone lied to you.
Or someone, exactly. But still, absolutely my favorite. But hey, listen, I really want to get to the interview we have with Ron Cooper, who's coming on, one of the world's foremost experts on Mezcal, and probably more important than anybody in the world to the current revival of Mezcal, both in Mexico and in the United States. So we'll be talking with him in just a moment. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guest today is Ron Cooper. Ron Cooper is an established artist and perhaps more than anyone else responsible for the explosion of the category known as Mezcal, specifically Mezcal from Oaxaca, but Mezcal from all over Mexico, that now rivals and in some places surpasses tequila as a specific genre.
Hey, Ron, feels like 100 years since we've had you on this show. Welcome back.
I think it's been 6, but I'm glad to be back.
It's good to hear from you again. Yeah. Ron, you are one of the foremost experts now. You've definitely established yourself in this area of the world and this type of spirit. But I think one of the things that a lot of our listeners confuse all the time is the difference between mezcal, tequila, sotol, all those little categories of spirit from that area of Mexico. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, give us a little two-minute primer on the differences of those spirits?
I can. If we go back 4 years, every spirit distilled from the agave, or what we call maguey in Mexico, was called mezcal. Tequila, it was a mezcal that 100 years ago requested a specific denomination of origin based around a little town called Tequila.
So tequila was a mezcal from a certain place.
Yes, from a town called Tequila. But in order to get that denomination of origin, they had to make some kind of compromise, and they said, okay, we'll just use the blue agave. So tequila has become very famous for producing an exquisite spirit made from the blue agave. So tol is an entirely different species of plant that really actually is not even in the Agavaceae family. It's a desert plant that is scientifically called Daisy Liron, and it has its own denomination of origin, and it used to be, you know, grouped as everything as mezcal, but now it is specifically sotol. Now, mezcal has a denomination of origin that unfortunately is only 7 states, and there are 21 or 26 states that really make good mezcal, Oaxaca being the foremost. A group of people put together this norma, set of rules, and a denomination of origin. So there are 7 legal, there are 5 states plus 2 states that have a few municipalities where you can legally make mezcal. And everything else in Mexico, all these other states are disregarded. You can't call the stuff mezcal legally, you know, on a bottle.
So what are they called?
Well, there's a big, it's really interesting because the Tequila Chamber of Commerce and Sotol are trying to actually outlaw the use of the word agave for all these farmers and all these states that, you know, that are making mezcal, legitimate mezcal, organic, the old way.
And they're making it from agave.
From agave, from 28 different agaves.
But they want to say that the government wants to say you can't
you can no longer use the word agave if you're not from one of these.
Yeah, and you can't use the word mezcal either. So we are fighting a battle in Mexico, enlisting consumers, aficionados, bartenders, writers, bloggers, everybody to participate and tell the government that there's a lot of people, and I think we have around 20,000 people now that are telling the government, hey, you know, you cannot destroy this ancient heritage. This is the most valuable resource you have.
Let's talk for a moment about what exactly is at risk and how important the production of agave spirits are to the various states of Mexico that aren't sort of recognized now as, like Oaxaca is recognized for the product that comes from there, and tequila is recognized for the product that comes from there. But it just because we don't know about these other states, this is really artisanal and something they've made for hundreds of years and is integral to their culture, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's a village called Nombre de Dios, Name of God. And there's one producer in that village, and it's where Jalisco, Durango, and Nayarit all touch, three states, okay?
Uh-huh.
And this guy makes an exquisite mezcal, and he starts the fermentation by adding pulque. Now, I'm bringing up another ancient spirit, you know, but pulque is like a beer or a wine fermented from two particular agaves, okay?
Okay.
Anyway, these are really heritage beverages, and every state has its, and every state has its villages, and every village or every other village has its maker. And each person is unique, and these traditions, the use of different wild agaves or cultivated agaves, mixes of both, have been handed down for generations and generations. And since we last talked, I've always said that mezcal is, well, that Del Maguey is the mother of all tequilas and mezcal. Well, since we've last talked, I've been to several forums in Guadalajara with archaeologists and anthropologists that have photographs of excavations at pyramid sites 800 years old with stills. So, you know, the traditional knowledge is that the Spanish, well, it's a myth that the Spanish brought the art of distillation. They brought copper stills to Mexico. But these people were using clay stills way before the Spanish conquered Mexico.
We need to stop right here and talk about, this is not just, us in the restaurant business and the spirits business, but distillation is a very important process to world trade, to the idea of science and where it originated. And it was always considered, was given fact when I was in high school and college, mm-hmm. that the science of distillation, which was not just used for recreation as well as I use it today, but was used for ritual purposes, religious purposes, and medicinal purposes, was invented, in the Far East, brought in through Europe, and then we brought it to those Native Americans who were savages and didn't know how to do it, and we taught them, and then of course they distilled the white man's lightning, and that ruined everything for them. That's a narrative that is really deeply ingrained. If they had distillation 800 years ago, that puts it before Europeans, does it, Ron, or contemporary with Europeans?
Yeah. Well, there's a very interesting book called 1421 that is about the Chinese sending this vast armada of junks around the world to bring back the most important people in the world to celebrate the building of Peking, Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's proof that the Chinese landed on the Pacific coast of Mexico in 1421, which is 78 years before Columbus discovered America.
Mm.
Okay? And the still that we use...
And it was good that he discovered America, because before he discovered them, those Native Americans didn't know what land they were on.
They knew where they were.
Yeah, I guess they did, didn't they?
You know, I'll go back to distillation, and that is it's one of the most important inventions, early inventions, and it's the great alchemical art of transformation, and it was used in the search to understand the essence of existence. You know, ancient Egypt, 4th century China, the Alexandrian Greeks, all of those people worked with this transformation. And I think one of the most brilliant things is that, if you're out at sea and perhaps something happened in a storm and you have no drinking water, all you have to do is boil some seawater and hold some cloth over the pot you're cooking in, and squeeze the vapor, and you have purified water.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's distillation.
Well, but we go back to the place of it in various Mexican cultures, back to before there was a Mexico and there were indigenous people. And when you talk about a trade organization that has consolidated a certain amount of gains. So first you had tequila, which consolidated its marketing gains, and the largest customer for tequila is America. Am I right about that?
Right, you're correct.
And then, due largely to your efforts, Ron, we now have Mezcal has a super strong hold both within Mexico and within the United States. And so the 7 states that have had success marketing their Mezcal want to preclude that name from everybody else. But, you know, it's already being used by those other folks. And what do they want to? They want to make it aguardiente del... What is the name
yes.
they want to force them to use?
Yes, they want to use the term aguardiente de agavecia,
so,
and outlaw the use of mezcal, outlaw the use of agave, the word agave.
And so here's how I see this whole thing is you have these producers who have achieved a level of success because people were willing to go outside of what was commonly known in tequila, namely you leading the pack, and you know, Americans embraced these small producers from these poor villages that make an exceptional product, and what they want to do is pull the ladder up behind them to keep, you know, the next generation of folks from going out and finding, you know, some small producer in another region. And
well, actually, it's not my producers nor any of the small farmer producers. There is the Regulatory Council of Tequila has a secondary unit that is the Chamber of Commerce of Tequila,
mm-hmm.
and they got the president of the Regulatory Council of Mezcal and the president of the Regulatory Council of Sotol to sign on to this greedy closing out of other people. But actually, the corrupt president of the Regulatory Council of Mezcal just got booted out, and there's been a revolution. And we have younger, cooler people that are not government appointees because, you know, they know rich people. We have real experts now that have been installed as the directorate of the Regulatory Council of Mezcal.
That's great. Well, you know, one of the things that was most interesting for Mark and I to watch from America is the number of American bartenders, New York bartenders, and every people involved in the spirits industry who really care about this, who went down to Mexico to testify before the governing bodies in Mexico to say this is a bad idea. And you may think, well, that's interfering in someone else's internal affairs, except, you know, we're the biggest customer. So
that's right.
You know,
if
American bartenders stop using Mezcal, well, there'd be nothing to argue about.
There wouldn't be at all. And the consumer, it should have a major voice. Because we're supporting that whole culture.
Yeah. Well, it's wild what has happened there politically, and you know, if people want to get involved, we did a show with Steve Olson where we talked about this in similar detail, and you can go to restaurantguysradio.com.
Yeah, that was within the last year.
Yeah, and you can look that up, and you can find out how to get involved yourself.
But
great. Let's talk about how exciting and interesting the mezcals that you've brought into this country are. You said to me something. I went to a seminar very recently in the spirit of full disclosure, while Mark ran the restaurant, thank you, Mark, of some really, you know, we've supported these mezcals of yours are on since you brought them into the country 15 years ago?
95 or 6, yeah.
And I'm very proud of that. And they were a small production, unheard of things back then, and now they're quite popular, and everybody who knows anything about bartending knows about Del Maguey mezcals. But we did this tasting of really small production, unusual things, and I want to talk about those small production mezcals in a moment. But what I'd like to for you to tell us, you struck me. I was struck when you said how things have changed in mezcal. I know in the United States, mezcal is almost cooler than tequila now, and in many corners of America, it is.
In most places.
But even in Mexico, the brand has changed.
Yes.
So tell me about marketing and the market penetration and who's drinking mezcal these days.
Okay. Let me start by telling you that in 1995, when I actually physically began Del Maguey, and you did a search for the word mezcal, there were only 2,500 mentions.
Huh.
Okay? I just did a search this morning, and mezcal with a Z, which is the way it should be spelled, gave 742,000 mentions.
Right. So that would be more.
Huh.
And what mezcal with an S, because of the Merriam-Webster dictionary, gave 3,490,000 hits. So uh-huh.
that would be way more.
It's 4,232,000 mentions.
And it would appear that we need to send Merriam-Webster a note.
They have been informed, and they actually have changed their thinking. Unfortunately, Microsoft and all those word processors still believe that it should be spelled with an S.
It's all
in time.
You get
a lot of mistakes.
But more important than on the web, what about in bars, in people's hands, and in people's glasses?
All right. Let's go back to your question. I just wanted to mention that. The shock to me, the surprise to me, is that in the last 4 or 5 years, nobody in Mexico under 35 drinks tequila. Everyone drinks mezcal, and they say, the stuff that my ancestors drank, my abuelos, my grandfather, I remember the good stuff, that's what he drank. So, you know, it's the change that's occurred everywhere, that rather than being brainwashed, everyone's seeking out more quality, just looking for more handmade products. And there are several bars that started out in Mexico City called La Botica, which means the drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these little, like, insulin-looking bottles filled with different mezcals, taking the cue from Del Maguey.
Uh-huh.
And they served mezcal and beer, and that was it. And there were four of them in Mexico City. Now, there's a place in Guadalajara called Pare de Sufrir, Toma Mezcal. It means stop suffering, drink mezcal. And it is a bar that serves only mezcal and beer.
And it's also a doctor's office.
No.
Do not believe Mark.
There's a place in Oaxaca called Mezcaloteca, which is like biblioteca. You know, biblioteca is library.
Right.
So Mezcaloteca it's actually not a bar. It's a library of mezcal. They have 35 different mezcals. They close at 10 o'clock at night. You can taste three, and that's it, because after that they feel you can't taste anymore.
Wow.
So they have...
But I've been practicing a long time, Ron.
Pardon?
I've been practicing a long time. I can taste more than three. I know I can.
I know I can, too, and I usually do there. But they like to really... They're very severe, and they're like, this is not a bar, you know? This is not a place to come and get high. This is a place to learn about mezcal. And they're very serious, this young couple, a woman from Mexico City, and then the young guy, Marcos, is from a beautiful Oaxacan... mezcal production region called Miahuatlan, and his family are producers, and they have mezcal from all over Mexico, and none of them are certified, You know, none of them, they are all these farmers that are, you know, the government that this Tequila Regulatory Council wants to exclude, and they all are using different wild agaves. So it is a beautiful lexicon. If you ever have a chance, you know, if anyone you know is going to Oaxaca, tell them to get into Mezcaloteca.
Well, let's talk about this for just one second, because you just brought up a point that I think is really important, because most Americans, unless it says blue agave on the bottle, I'm not buying it, because blue agave is the best and everything else is just not very good.
Many Americans.
I'm sorry.
Fewer and fewer.
I think most Americans, more than 50%, most.
Oh, sure, at this point. Yeah.
Are when they look at the bottle, they say, I can only drink the blue agave. Can you explain to everybody that maybe that's not the case?
Well, yeah, but also I think it's more interesting than that, and that is the case of this spirit called Patron, okay? It's actually its own category. It's not even tequila, even though, you know, it is legally tequila. But consumers of Patron don't even know that it's made from agave, okay? Let alone blue agave.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that really interesting. I don't think people that drink tequila look at, you know, generally, the general public, majority of people, they don't look at what tequila is made out of. It's the word tequila. That's what they're drinking. You know?
It's an image.
It's an image.
Although, yeah. let it be said, there are some very good tequilas out there. There are some really lovely tequila producers out there. But there are also, I have seen, and I don't want to mention any producer in particular, but I have seen, we've experienced this with 3 or 4 or 5 producers in the last 10 years we've been doing business, that the quality of tequila production, there's been some changes in ownership, and then you see the quality of tequila production at that facility just, you know, go, as tasters of spirits, just go right down from, you know, a respectable spirit or a very nice spirit even. Some of them have really fallen off the floor. Things used to be our house tequilas. I don't even buy it anymore.
I won't mention those names either. Look, you guys are artisans, okay? You're restaurateurs. And artisanal, you know, family-made is important.
Mm-hmm.
Handmade is important, you know? And what's going on in the greater world is the bottom line and economics. And these distilleries get bought, and they get bought and brought into a bigger house of distribution, and it doesn't matter what the quality is. They have X percent of distribution in the United States, and, you know, China, man, is like exploding.
You know,
with some of these producers, I really feel like the mom and pop bakery was bought by, you know, Hostess and turned into the Twinkie factory.
Yeah.
And they kept the name and everything.
The bottle looks the same.
Everything
on the outside
looks the same until you open it up and taste it, and then you're like, somebody put a Twinkie in here.
Whoops. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Well, you know, I do want to offend. There's one I'll point out in particular is Excelia Tequila, which we found recently, which I think is really a very respectable product, and there are others. But it strikes me that the consumer who is like, I want some tequila, is more susceptible to marketing, or maybe they're because of really great marketing, whereas the guy who's looking for, man or woman, guy being a gender-neutral term, who's looking for mezcal, who goes in specifically looking for a mezcal, is someone who's like, hey, I've heard that mezcal is great. Let me taste it. And what kind of different mezcals do you have? And that's a different, it's almost like a different consumer. The people who are looking for quality or looking for adventure are looking to try something, taste it, and decide for themselves whether they like it or not. And it's very akin to the difference between, and is a broad generalization that is not always true, the consumers of vodka and the consumers of single malt scotch. As a bartender, every bartender knows if you've got a broad single malt scotch selection, people come in and say, hey, even professional scotch drinkers, which I consider myself one, or at least advanced recreational scotch drinker.
Oh, you're professional, all right.
Advanced, you know, recreational.
Don't kid yourself.
But I walk into a bar that's got a great scotch selection, I feel like a whiskey, and I say, hey, you know, what kind of single malt whiskey do you have? No one, in all my years behind the bar, no one has ever walked in behind the bar and said, hey, what kind of vodka do you have? You know what I mean? It's like, that you've already the advertising has already worked on you. You know what kind of vodka you're going to order because of the magazine ad you saw. And I think
right.
that right now many people are brought to tequila by what they're supposed to like, and I think people are looking at for mezcal to make the decision themselves.
Yes. Well, you know, mezcal taps into the mystical past, and it retains the ancient mysteries, you know, and it embraces the notion of intoxication from the maguey as a gift from the gods. So there is a real adventure to tasting a mezcal. You know, it takes you way back.
Ron, I'm gonna just dilute this down a little bit and say, I really drink mezcal for the way it tastes. Sorry.
I drink the first few for the way they taste. No, I really do. But hey, listen, we need to take a quick break, Ron. I want to come back on the other side, and I want to talk about some really specific little offerings and that show how mezcal can be as sort of like wine and sort of like spirits. And I also want to talk a little bit about the villages that the Del Maguey mezcals come from. Will you stick with us for just a moment?
Absolutely.
We'll be back on the other side with Ron Cooper of Del Maguey Mezcals. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Stick with us.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Ron Cooper of Del Maguey Single Village Mezcals from Oaxaca. And he's a man who's pretty responsible, more than anyone else, for bringing this category to bear. And it's a hot category, and it's really worth the hype because there are some really remarkable things happening all around with tiny little producers. Let's talk for just a second. One of the things that really struck me about this is we had a recent seminar where, and you know, we've been familiar with your career from the beginning. We've worked together since we first met 15 years ago. But you did a retrospective of, I was always shocked when I saw videos of how this is produced and where it's produced. Very often you need to hike past where there's a paved road out into very poor regions of Mexico. And, I mean, shockingly poor regions of Mexico. And prior to your arrival, these folks weren't really able to sell their very wonderful artisanal product for anything that could really lift them out of that. And you pay some above commodity pricing for your mezcals. You gave me a factor. Is it 20 times above or something like that?
Well, from 5 to 20 times, yes.
Yeah. So
depending on the producer. But let me say one thing. Shockingly poor makes me think of some remote villages in Afghanistan, mm-hmm, or Pakistan, mm-hmm, or India, Africa. I actually think that these villages were shockingly rich.
Okay.
Because even though they were 4 hours out a dirt road from the nearest pavement, they had these incredible natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
And their traditions, their ancient traditions were intact.
And a strong community. And
they had, yeah, like, unbelievable community.
Yeah.
So, which was pre-Hispanic, and there are 16 indigenous languages still spoken in Oaxaca today. So, they were more primitive, but not, I wouldn't say shockingly poor, I would say shockingly primitive.
Well, yeah. But
which is beautiful.
In a way it is. But one of the things that I was struck by was getting what is a fair price for their product, because frankly, your mezcals are not inexpensive, certainly, but they are certainly a fair price for the nature of what you're getting. And I think that having a fair share of the proceeds winding up back in these people's hands is revolutionary, and it's made some differences over the last 15 years in how they live. And you talk a little bit about that in our seminar. Why don't you share that?
Right.
Can you share that with our listeners? What
sure.
They've been able to do, getting a fair share of the profits for their work?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, I have a signature on my email that says pre-organic, pre-green, pre-fair trade, pre-slow. And it's true, because when I started 18 years ago, there was very little product out in the world that talked about fair trade or being green or sustainable. But these people practiced those notions traditionally. And we have given ownership in overall Del Maguey to each of our producers, so that, you know, it's like we want them to be participating in our success. Previously, the pressure on them, you know, they made mezcal for the ritual use in their villages, for births and deaths and funerals.
Well, now they're making
weddings.
It for the ritual use in my village.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they really didn't do cocktails or a little shot of mezcal in the afternoon after work. They waited until there was a fiesta in the village. And then you were encouraged to drink as much as you wanted because it got you closer to the gods.
I felt
now,
that.
When I started, a lot of our people had one main room they lived in and an outdoor wood fire cooking area. And everyone, the whole family, the mother and father and all the kids, maybe some grandkids, all slept on a dirt floor on a woven palm mat, like a mother dog with her puppies, you know, just keeping warm together. Now, you know, everyone has bedrooms and beds and cement floors, and some people have brilliantly tiled floors, and their properties have expanded. You know, they invest in building, and one of our villages, our most remote village, previously our most remote village, that had one bus that went in and out every Sunday. That was it.
So if you're going to vacation there, you're there for a week.
That's right. So they actually sent two daughters down to Oaxaca City on the money they were making from Del Maguey, and they rented an apartment. And one daughter did all the cooking and shopping and cleaning so the other daughter could go to university. And I was invited to a fiesta 2 years ago, and that daughter is the first college graduate from this village, and she's an attorney.
That's awesome.
So it's like, you know, that kind of story, you know, we're family now. Everyone in these remote villages looked at this gringo, this white guy, coming in with his Zapotec Indian buddy and driving in a big white 1978 Cadillac Coupe de Ville, raised way up off the ground with truck tires, you know, a really badass vehicle.
Sounds like the beginning of some kind of bad movie from the 70s, Ron.
It is. and it's like, you know, they looked at me like I was, the car was a flying saucer, and I was an alien, and they were so suspicious. And, you know, it took a while, you know, a few years, and they were still suspicious of their good luck that this was happening. But we are family now.
That's awesome, Ron.
That's a great story.
I was down there, and, you know, I go down 10 times a year for 2 weeks at a time, or a week, or 3 weeks, whatever. And each one of my producers, and these Zapotec Indians never touch you, and they put their hand on my shoulder, and they said, contento, I'm content, meaning I'm very happy.
That's
you know,
that's a
and
cultural.
It was an amazing thing to have them speak about their deep emotional feeling that Del Maguey has made life great for them.
Well, and that's a cultural thing. They don't touch you unless they're close to you.
When you shake hands, it's not like, you know, it's really weird because, you know, Americans, you know, you grip somebody's hand and you shake it, right?
Right, right.
They put their two hands together like a prayer,
uh-huh.
you know, out straight in front of them, and the other person does it too, and they just touch, and that's it.
Touch fingertips.
Yep.
That's really cool.
And actually, that's a modernization of taking an elder's hand in between your two hands, open hands, and bending over and kissing their hand as a salute.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, I think it's amazing what has happened with Del Maguey down there. And one of the things that's really great about it is there is no inclination to combine resources and you know, make one kind of marketable mezcal that there is a million bottles of. One of the great things to come out of Del Maguey is the more successful you become, the more iterations of small variations from different places of mezcal that come out.
There is no, just for those of you who don't know the mezcals, there is no kind of like, this is our entry level that everybody
silver,
has.
Silver, gold,
this
and...
This is our middle level. Each place is from its place,
right.
And is different and interesting and exciting and tiny.
Well, you know, one of the things that mezcals have that a lot of other spirits don't have, or very few spirits have, is terroir. You know, the taste of the place. You can really taste the place. And so each different producer, there are some great wines that really have, you know, that sense of the earth.
Just step in and just define terroir in a down and dirty kind of way. When we talk about terroir,
I get it down and dirty.
It's funny. People use the French word terroir because it implies more than just, you know, dirt. It's the idea that, you know, you can have two vineyards next to each other and experienced tasters can taste different wines from different producers and they'll be able to say, you know, this is from characteristically from this vineyard and this is characteristically from that vineyard, or this is from this village and that is from that village, based on the sense of place that you can taste. And we find that in mezcal when it's made like this, and only when it's made like this, as well. Now, Ron, is it really the difference in the sense of place of the way the agave is structured and tastes that comes through into the distilling, or is it slight differences in mashing, fermenting, distilling
tradition
from village to village?
It's all of those things. There, for me, I've kind of broken it down into seven different factors that create flavor in mezcal. The hand of the maker is very important, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The kind of wood used in heating the rocks for the underground roast is really important.
Can you just explain the underground roast and the heated rocks? Because I don't think a lot of people know that that's how traditional mezcal is made, and it's
sure,
very
there's
cool.
There's a horrible myth that it's... cooked over hot coals, which is like just infuriates me, okay? There are these cone-shaped pits in the earth that they've actually discovered here in southern New Mexico from 4,000 years ago. These cone-shaped pits in the earth where they put a lot of firewood down in the bottom and then they cover it with rocks. They heap rocks over it. And then they open a little hole in the middle, and they drop some hot coals in, and the fire burns for 12 hours, 8 to 12 hours. And finally, the fire's out, and the rocks are red hot. Now you're ready to start cooking agave or maguey. Then you put used fiber over the rocks so the hearts don't burn, and you heap these hearts up to 10 tons over these hot rocks, and then you cover it all with more fiber, woven palm mats, and then about a foot of earth. So it's like a luau where these hearts cook in the earth for 3 to 5 days, a slow conversion, and they get smoky because the rocks have gotten the smoke of the fire. You know, they've gotten coated with oil from the oak of the fire or the wild other heartwoods that they use to heat these rocks. And so this circulates in this underground oven. It cooks 3 to 5 days for around 350 degrees. The hot, when you uncover it, the hearts are still, you know, like steaming hot, and they've gone from green to a caramel brown. And you have this really rich, smoky flavor. Tequila traditionally is steam cooked now to speed things up. It's more efficient. But you don't extract the same flavors when you cook with steam.
Think about if you're at home, okay, we're going to make some vegetables tonight. Either we can dig a pit out in the backyard and slow roast them over hot rocks, or I'll put them in the steamer and we can have them in 10 minutes. Which ones do you think are going to taste better?
Well, yeah, a boiled onion or a roasted caramelized onion.
Yeah.
You know,
so,
there's a real difference in the flavor.
And so when we talk about artisanal, I mean, this is a lot of hard work, right?
Definitely hard work, yes. Yeah, it's very labor-intensive. You know, any one of our producers working really hard with helpers can make from 300 to 1,000 liters a month.
And that's it.
That's it.
Well, this brings me to my next topic, because we only have a little bit of time left, and I do want to talk about some of the things that you showed me, taking it to an extreme level, in our tasting of last month, where we had some of the best bartenders in New York, and it was you and our buddy Steve Olson was there as well. What you did there was an unprecedented thing. Has it ever been done in the world before, that tasting, that kind of tasting?
I don't think so, because I think we served at least 14 different mezcals.
Yeah, 14 different mezcals, and the idea was different types of mezcal and then different senses of place, different villages from different elevations.
And again, this was a seminar given at the Manhattan Cocktail Classic by Ron and Steve Olson, and I'm sorry, there's one other gentleman.
Jimmy Yeager.
Right, Jimmy Yeager.
Yeah, from Jimmy's in Aspen. Well, this was kind of a side event, and it was at Victor and Spoils, which is a new bar down on Rivington. And Steve Olson and Jimmy Yeager have been Del Maguey's biggest supporters since the very beginning. And this is an opportunity for us to be together and take everyone on a trip and bring them up to date. And you know, we introduced these mezcals that are wild that I'm bringing in now, that I'm bringing in like 50 cases, that's 300 bottles for the entire United States. Some even less. I think Arroqueño, I think 42 cases came in, you know. So the major propagated agave in Oaxaca is called espadín, and it means the sword. The leaves are narrower than the blue agave, and the espadín turns out to be the genetic mother of the blue agave.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an older traditional agave. And then there are these wild agaves, the Tobalá, Tepestate, Arroqueño, that are, you know, they're only God plants them. Tobalá only grows in the shade of oak trees like truffles. The hearts are tiny. These plants take 15 to 25 years to mature. The Maguey Barril takes 25 years. Tobasiche takes 10 or 15 years. You know, the blue agave and the espadín are fast growing at 7 years.
You know,
and I just want to point out, and one of the things that you get when you have a village of people who are responsible for these agave
and have been responsible for it for 300 years and expect to be responsible for it for the next 300 years.
Is
more than that, longer than that,
right.
Yes.
Is what you get is, you don't. They don't say, hey, let's chop them all down and make a lot of money this year.
Right, right.
That's right.
Okay, that doesn't happen.
Because they have to worry about their ancestors.
It's their lifeline.
Yeah.
Their ancestors and their descendants.
Right.
They got to worry about the whole lineage.
Right.
I'm here in Taos, New Mexico, and a neighbor of mine, Candido Mondragon, told me one time, because we had a little property encroachment about a foot over 90 feet. You know, there was like a little curve where his fence kind of got pushed in by some trees. And the surveyor just, hey, you've got to move this property line. Candido Mondragon kind of pushed the guy out of the way and looked at me and smiled, and he said, I'll get my own surveyor to check this out and make sure it's right. God don't make new land anymore. And these guys, these villages have been there for way more than 300 years,
yeah.
800 years,
yeah.
1,000 years. And each one of these villages in Oaxaca have about 100,000 acres. And part of it is down on the plains, and then part of it is in the foothills, and then part of it is in the mountains. And each one of these villages, every year, all the men in the village have to get together with the neighboring village on the right side and clean this cut where it's like bare. And they, you know, like 20 feet wide, the entire length of the coinciding of these two villages. They do it on one side, they do it on the other side, so that everybody knows that this is our property, this
yeah.
is our village mm-hmm. land, and we're going to take care of it. And no one from the other village is going to encroach on their village. And before you cut firewood, you go to the village government and you ask for permission to go up into the mountains and harvest these trees to build with or for firewood, whatever. And depending on how much you've given to your village, how much work you've given to your village, they allot you permission to cut or plant, you know, to have orchards. All of it is an old system before the Spanish, and they husband their land. It's unbelievable.
Well, you spoke about a really interesting thing to me when we talked about, we think about, you know, the wisdom of European feudal crop rotation to keep soils nourished. You
yeah.
talked about coincidental planting of different crops at the same time, which basically did that all at once. I mean, do you remember that off the top of your head, what crops they used to make this cycle work all at the same time?
Sure. There are two different kinds of planting they do, but they have rows of agave that are about 4 or 5 meters apart, about 15 feet apart. And down the middle, well, anyway, the agave like to suffer. They don't want to be irrigated. All they want to be is weed-free. So
Ron, I hate to suffer, and I want to be irrigated.
Well, these guys are the opposite,
okay.
you know. And down the center, for 5 years, they can plant corn, beans, and squash, okay? And after 5 years, the agaves have grown too large for you to get down the middle with your two oxen team to plow. So it's over. So, and at that point, the agaves don't care if they have weeds or not. They're really established, okay? So the corn, which is the mainstay of the Mexican culture, corn, beans, and squash, the corn provides a vertical thing for the beans to grow on, okay? And the squash grow down low, you know, and just on the ground.
And don't mind the shade.
They don't mind the shade at all. And also, the particular squashes they grow are not like our zucchini up here. They have a hard shell, and it's like a canned food. They last a year after they've been harvested.
That's awesome.
They harvest them and put them under their family altar, because they're such a sacred thing.
Wow.
And then they have to really, you know, use a big hammer or something and whack these things to break them open to boil them and cook them.
That's wild. That's wild.
You know, so it's, and the beans, of course, are dried, and they're reconstituted, and the corn is the same. You know, they hardly eat any fresh corn on the cob like we do. They eat a little bit, but it's a rarity. They really dry all their corn on the stalks, and harvest it very late in the fall and scrape all the kernels off and save the kernels. Now, the rest of the corn stalk becomes animal feed. It's just a brilliant, it's a brilliant, brilliant system. And there's one other thing that a food scientist, I can't remember who, but in the last 6 months said, you know, this is the perfect combination of foods for humans, corn, beans, and squash. And there's one other thing, and that's the maguey, which has amino acids, okay, that these other things don't have. So the maguey actually completes the cycle.
Completes the protein.
Yeah.
Well, there's one other thing that I would love for you to just tell people about. What I want to talk about is what I want everyone to understand is that when we talk about the different types of agave that are out there, and we talk about espadín or tobasiche or tepestate or tobalá, it's sort of like, you know, the different grapes that make wine. You know, it's the basic makeup of the different grapes that make wine. But the thing that is most striking about understanding the agriculture of agave is how agave reproduces, some of the dramatic ways in which the agave plant reproduces. Can you tell us how that,
sure,
involving lightning? I mean, it's crazy. So,
yeah, there are three ways. You know, commonly people in America know about the century plant, you know. Well, the agave shoots up a flower stalk that goes up 25, 30 feet in the air.
That's 30 feet in the air. And how long does it take that stalk to grow from? So it's an innocent little plant. It's minding its business. And then it starts to throw up this stalk. How long does it take that stalk to all of a sudden go up 30 feet in the air?
Maybe this is where the Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. You guys won't believe this, but the flower stalk grows 4 inches a day.
Wow. That's a lot.
I have stood still and really still and watched, and you can see it grow.
That's awesome.
Now, once it gets up there, it sends out like branches 30 feet in the air. And these flower, they look kind of like peanuts, these little flower nodules. Before they open and flower, they're like a green peanut. Now, the espadín is very weak, and these flowers bloom, but they don't get fertilized. They're not very fertile because the fertilizers were the bat, the butterfly, and the hummingbird, and they got decimated in the 50s because of DDT. Hmm. So the seeds are weak because they don't get enough pollinization. And the seeds eventually will fall and replant. But meanwhile, the plant also, starting at 3 years old, sends out tuberous runners, as far out as 6 feet from the mother plant, and shoot up baby agave. So over the course of the life of a plant, from 3 to 7 years, let's say, it may put out 20 new plants around it. And when they're about a foot tall, you break them off, off this tuberous underground structure, you break it off, and you dry them in the shade for a week or two, and you can go out and plant these things, and they just grow like crazy. So there's a third way, and that is, I don't know who discovered this, but if you can get up on a ladder up 30 feet where these little flower nodules are about to open, and you cut them in half, and you eat the top half, and they're delicious in escabeche and scrambled eggs. They're really good. But if you cut them, they begin to grow airborne agaves. And one plant will give you 1,000 new airborne agaves.
That's amazing.
It sounds like we need to introduce giraffes into this population.
With half an appetite.
And
they just float away, these little airborne agaves just float away on the wind?
Well, they drop pretty close to the mother, but you can shake the stalk and shake them down. Some of them are like 3 inches, some of them are an inch. And you can plant those in little nurseries, and after a year and a half, they're ready to go out into the mountains and get planted.
That's amazing.
And, you know, Mezcal and Oaxaca are different than tequila region, because in tequila there are these vast fields of agaves. In Oaxaca, they're just like 20 of them are planted over here in one little pocket, and 4 over here, and 12 over there. There are no huge plantations. And so they're really growing in, you know, unique microclimates. And there are different kinds of soils that they like. You know, decomposed granite. There are a white kind of chalky soil like Champagne and Cognac come from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are all these different soils that may, half a mile away, may be different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these plants growing in all these different little micro terroirs.
That's amazing. Well, you know, Ron, I'm afraid we're running a little short on time.
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't get to talk about, you know, a lot of the flavor profiles in your mezcal, but I have a wonderful idea that I recommend that everybody who's listening to the show go out to, you know, some cool bar that carries these mezcal and have a couple of them side by side, because they are absolutely amazing to taste these side by side. And I remember when you first brought them into the market, we bought 4 different mezcals, and we would do it all the time and serve an ounce of each mezcal to a group and let them just taste each one through.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I strongly recommend that you do that and find a cool place that carries a bunch of them and taste them side by side.
Hey, you guys. Thank you so much.
It's super. Del Maguey is DelMaguey. You should ask for it at the local bar. We're going to get some of those really tiny production ones in. Ron's been kind enough to make sure that we're on the list to get maybe 3 or 4 of those really small, obscure ones in. We carry them all. They're a lot of fun. Come into the bar at Catherine Lombardi or Stage Left and try them. And who knows, maybe one day you'll run into Ron. We have a moment for a quick plug on your art, Ron?
Sure.
Ron Cooper is also an artist, a very successful and acclaimed artist, and he has a show here in New York going on right now, May 5th through July 27th, 2012. He's at NYE House. That's NYEHAUS. It's on 20th Street and 9th Avenue. If you can check it out, it'll be here for a while.
Lightworks.
Lightworks is the name of the show. Absolutely.
Thanks, Ron. We'll see you in New Orleans in a few weeks.
Great.
Yeah, Tales of the Cocktail. Are you going to be there?
I certainly am.
For all you cocktailians going to be down in New Orleans in July, the restaurant guys will be there covering the event, and we'll be sure to, if you spot 3 strange-looking guys and a 1970s Cadillac with oversized tires parked out front, you'll know that the restaurant guys and Ron Cooper
sipping out of clay cups. Yeah. Well, we can do the tasting there.
Excellent. So, Ron, fabulous to have you on the show. It's an education every time I talk to you, and the tequilas are phenomenal. Doing God's work down there.
Hey, I love your show. And remember, M for mother, M for mezcal. And I look forward to seeing you guys soon.
Thanks so much, Ron.
Excellent, man. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to The Restaurant Guys. Love that guy. I love the little clay cups that you drink the mezcal out of. I think we've got a lot of those are broken. We have to get some more of those for the restaurant.
We definitely have a few of them. We drank a mezcal made by Ron called Pechuga out of them a long time ago, which was a really cool thing that he only made 300 bottles a year of, and really magnificent mezcal.
I have to say, when Ron was talking about it, he said something like, you know, that really irritates me. That really makes me mad. I forget what he's talking about. And he had just told us about the Cadillac with the oversized tires and the pulling up. And I just got this picture of, like, don't do that or Ron Cooper will show up at your house and the Cadillac pulling up and dust behind it and some bandoleros.
I was just about saying 8 Mexican Indians are going to kick the crap out of you.
No, I was just thinking him and some pistols and bandoleros, you know, like the tequila police. I'm sorry.
You know, Ron,
I said tequila again. I'm so brainwashed. I meant mezcal.
Yeah.
Mezcal.
Keep trying.
I'm trying.
One of the things that I really appreciate is Ron has really integrated himself into their lives. Okay, Ron cares about these little villages. You hear it in his voice.
Yeah.
You know it when you talk to him. He's very passionate about this. You know that this was not a profitable endeavor for him for a long time. And he's just kept at it and enriched these people's lives and enriched everybody else's life in the United States who've gotten to try the products and see things that they never would have seen.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're singular.
Ron is, you know, alone out there.
Was.
I'm sorry. Ron was alone out there on the frontier, literally, going into these places that no one else has been in. But there's something else I want to point out. And Francis and I had this experience just within the last week to 10 days. Somebody came to us with some tequila that was in a beautiful bottle.
Oh, yeah, and that bottle was great.
Really, really just, you know, had to be a $50 bottle. I mean,
that was a beautiful, heavy, gorgeous bottle.
And they brought us some tequilas, a silver and a reposado and a gold tequila. And one was, I think the silver was $100 a bottle on the shelf, and the other one, the next one was $150, and the aged was aged in Chateau de Chem barrels.
Ah, very expensive wine barrels.
So aged in massively expensive used wine barrels. And the retail price was $250 or $300 a bottle. Please understand that not all products are correlated by price.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're just paying for the shiny bottle or
the idea that it's expensive.
Or the idea that it should be expensive. And again, you know, honestly, these were not bad tequila. And if they were $30 a bottle, I would have said, hey, those are interesting.
Yeah.
But at $250 a bottle, that somebody just got the idea of, I'm going to package this and brand it,
right.
You know, got their idea from watching Entourage that, you know, I'll create a marketing scheme and everybody will have to have this.
Right.
There's a lot of products out there that are like that. Seek out the ones that are real. Seek out the ones that come from a true story. Seek out the ones that where the value's in the bottle, not the value is the bottle.
Yeah, no, I remember we're usually not rude to people, to their face, when we're tasting. And the guy was in our office, and he came in with a rep from a company that was distributing it, and you know, that's their job. And the guy poured the tequila for us, and we were so shocked that I had to be honest with the guy. And I think the guy knew all this. He'd memorized the fact sheet very well, but he really did. He didn't know a lot about spirits, you know, but this is his job. He's a salesman. And I thought, first of all, if you're sending out the salesman to visit your premium accounts with the $250 bottle wholesale, by the way, right. I'm not talking your prices. I'm talking the restaurant would pay $250 a bottle. And I thought, you got to send out somebody who really understands tequila, not just he's memorized everything about your tequila. And I thought, and we said to the guy, I said, you're crazy.
Yeah.
Insane. The prices ridiculous.
Were outlandish.
Anyway.
The problem with this.
He's a nice guy. He just
nice enough guy.
Have frame
he didn't
of reference.
Right. And that's exactly what I was going to say. He didn't understand that, you know what, there's tequilas in the marketplace that are $40, and there's mezcals in the marketplace that are $30 that are more enjoyable than the mezcal you've just brought me for $250.
The bottles, though, aren't as nice, and what you want, though, is the bottle. Go to a glass company.
Drink fast, enjoy the bottle. And
I suggest you buy the bottle and buy another tequila or mezcal and drink
and
it while looking at that bottle. That's what I suggest you do. And I hope you all have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.